Good morning. You're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by the volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Diane, and I will be reading from The Sun, and I'm joined by Susan, who will be reading from the Tribune. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Diane.
How are you?
Doing well. How are you? Welcome back. It's
been
a while.
Yeah, long time no reading.
Yes.
All right, so I'm going to start off with healthcare information, and I'm interested in this article because I get part of my healthcare through the state. So Governor blasts GOP on Obamacare credits. Governor Maury Healey is demanding congressional Republicans vote to extend a set of tax credits under the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, to prevent what she calls skyrocketing healthcare costs across the country, as well as here in Massachusetts. Healey held a press conference Tuesday at the State House, demanding the extension and slamming President Donald Trump for potentially letting the Obamacare credits expire. Over 328,000 Massachusetts residents and households use the state health connector and will see up to $25,000 increases in their insurance premiums next year if they're not extended. She also hit on previous criticisms she recently made of the Trump administration, including tariffs on Canadian products, the delay in distributing low-income home energy assistance program funds following the government shutdown, and for withholding SNAP benefits to 21 Democrat-ran states, including Massachusetts, beginning this week, for refusing to provide USDA-required data on recipients. From the moment he took office, President Trump has been making costs go up for American people. From his tariffs to cutting SNAP to taking away heating assistance, now millions of Americans will see their health care costs skyrocket because he let the tax credits that people rely on to afford their insurance expire, Healey said. These are our small business owners, self-employed people, middle-class families, and single parents. Women with breast cancer will lose access to treatment. People with heart disease won't get the care they desperately need. Children won't get the medicine they need for asthma. No one can afford this. We need President Trump and congressional Republicans to do their jobs and vote to lower people's health costs on Thursday, she said. Healey's office said the average premium will jump by $1,300 a year, with some jumping as high as $10,000 or $25,000 without the extension. Her office says that tens of thousands of enrollees will also lose subsidies totaling about $425 million in low tax credits in the Bay State. Congresswoman and House Minority Whip Catherine Clark is also calling on Republicans to extend the tax credits, adding that House Democrats are close to filing a discharge petition, a rare congressional maneuver to vote a bill out of committee. Clark posted on X Monday, ACA tax credits expire in 23 days. All House Democrats have signed our discharge petition to protect health care and lower cost. We need just four Republicans to join us. But Senate Republicans argue the COVID-era subsidies were meant to be temporary and are no longer needed and have yet to come together around an alternative plan. Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, has not indicated any interest in bringing the ACA tax credit extension issue to the floor for a vote. Instead, House Republicans have presented several other proposals on ways to redirect, end, and extend ACA funds, but not have garnered enough support around a single plan. Congressman Mike Lauer, Republican out of New York, has expressed his support for a two-year extension of ACA subsidies, while also blaming Obama itself for skyrocketing healthcare premiums ever since it was enacted. I and many of my colleagues have been working for weeks on a bipartisan solution, which would be a 2-year extension of the subsidies with income limits. Lawler posted Monday on X. As I have said repeatedly, we must deal with the short-term issue of the expiration of the enhanced subsidies, as well as the long-term issue, which is the fact that since Obamacare took effect, healthcare premiums have risen over 96% nationwide. A Thursday vote being forced by Senate Democrats is the result of negotiations to end the recent government shutdown, with Senate Majority Leader Joe Thune, Republican of South Dakota, agreeing to hold a Senate vote on any bill Democrats propose. Democrats will need 60 votes to pass the extension, meaning at least 13 Republicans will have to come across the aisle and vote in favor of it. Healy and the Massachusetts Health Connector also announced a new online portal, the Get an Estimate tool, for state residents to navigate the potential federal changes to their health insurance. Our enrollees and our new applicants need information and a clear picture of what they're facing next year. The Get an Estimate tool is easy to use and provides details on available plans and premium prices that people need now, said Executive Director of Massachusetts Health Connector Audrey Morse-Gastier. Taking a minute to use the tool is worth it for enrollees and new applicants to make sure they understood their options for next year. The Health Connector's open enrollment period started on November 1st and runs through January 23rd. The deadline for coverage to start the new year is December 23rd. There are more than 376 people in Health Connector coverage, of which over 328,000 use the so-called enhanced premium tax credits to pay for health insurance, according to the state. I happen to be one of those people, so I hope it all works out. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. In the Eagle Tribune, subpoena to testify at ex-chief's hearing in Boston. Lawrence Mayor Brian Dipina could testify as early as Wednesday for his political ally, William Castro, who is attempting to get his policing privileges restored by a state oversight board. Castro, a former Lawrence police chief, was stripped of policing credentials after he was involved in a high-speed chase and then falsified reports regarding the incident, authorities said. Octavian Spanner, Dipina's senior advisor, and Castro himself are on the witness list in the hearing this week before the Peace Officer Standard and Training Commission, or POST, in Boston. Castro has appealed his discipline by post, and the hearing before the commission started Tuesday morning. It's unclear if Spanner will testify in person or via Zoom, as there was a discussion at the conclusion of Tuesday's hearing about him being out of the country. An interpreter will be needed for Dipina's testimony. Called by Post's enforcement attorney, Timothy Hartnett, several Lawrence police officers testified on Tuesday, including Lieutenant Paul Rossi, an LPD internal affairs investigator. A male in a green hoodie who tried to pass a bad check was a description a Lawrence police dispatcher gave out over a police radio frequency on February 2, 2024, after the incident that led to Castro's discipline and removal as police chief. A tape of the dispatcher's transmission was played numerous times Tuesday during the hearing. After the bad check report on February 2, 2024, Castro, in a full-size SUV, is accused of speeding the wrong way up a city street in an improper police chase. He is also accused of lying in a police report, saying he had responded to an armed bank robbery instead of the lesser offense of a person who had attempted to cash a bad check, authorities said. Rossi, an internal affairs investigator, was a first witness testifying Tuesday regarding emails he sent to Dipina regarding Castro's involvement in the chase and subsequent emails he received from Spanner, Dipina's senior aide. One email from Spanner asked for detailed information regarding all LPD internal affairs investigations. Rossi said he questioned Spanner about the email, and Spanner told him he didn't write the questions. Castro's attorney, Walter Jacobs, asked Rossi if he had any bias against Castro. Rossi explained when he first met Castro, they had a decent relationship, but it deteriorated over time. I currently don't think very highly of him, Rossi said. LPD Captain Ariel Montas testified Tuesday afternoon, recalling a budget meeting Castro attended after he was removed as police chief and ordered not to be involved in LPD affairs. Acting police chief Melix Bonilla was also at the meeting, but Montas said Castro was calling the shots. I don't think anyone in that room could have mistaken who was running the police department, Montas said. Jacobs questioned Montas about his sister, Francesca, who works as a confidential secretary in the personnel department at Lawrence City Hall. He asked Montas about an error allegedly made on a promotional list for sergeant. The first I've heard of it is in this room, Montas said. All hearing witnesses are sequestered and cannot discuss their testimony outside of the hearing. A consultant's report ordered by the city and released in January 2025 called for Castro's termination. Acting Chief Castro broke the law in an effort to cover up a mistake that he made, said the report, prepared by Comprehensive Investigations and Consulting. Instead of accepting the consequences for his actions, he fabricated a false police report. A police officer cannot put inaccurate information into a police report. As the leader of the Lawrence Police Department, this conduct is unacceptable. The most important quality an officer possesses is their integrity. Acting Chief Castro has sacrificed his integrity for his own benefit. Lawrence Police Department's sworn oath of office states that officers commit to be honest in thought and deed in both my personal and official life, it continues. The consultant's report also recommended termination for action Castro took to hire an unqualified candidate and for involving himself in police department issues and discussions at City Hall after the state stripped him of his policing credentials in March 2024. Castro is a retired county correctional officer. He still works for Depina as his chief of staff, earning an annual salary of $145,600. The post-hearing is expected to resume at 9:30 a.m. Wednesday. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, three Lowell schools named Schools of Recognition by DESE. Three Lowell schools were named as Schools of Recognition by the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education this year after they each displayed significant academic improvement after being among the lowest performing schools in the state. The Moody Elementary School, Washington Elementary School, and Stocklosa Middle School received the honors. In the case of the Moody School, which was recognized by the school committee on November 19th, the school saw a 30 percentile point improvement in math and English language arts in just the last 2 years. The school went from being in the 6th percentile among the lowest to the 36th percentile, a significant improvement for the school in that time. This marks the second consecutive year Moody Elementary has been recognized for academic growth. Every single school is working hard to support our children. We are very grateful for the support we get from Central Office and the community, Moody Elementary Principal Roberta Keefe told the school committee. For Washington Elementary School, Principal Jeffrey Haynes told The Sun Tuesday the biggest struggle was in English language arts, due in part to the volume of English language learners that makes up the school student population. Our biggest focus was to make sure that they had a mastery of English language, said Haynes, who is in his third year as principal of Washington Elementary. The school administration would review academic data every 6 to 8 weeks, Haynes said, to see where kids were making improvements and where their approach was not quite working. The effort was a collaborative one between multi-language learner teachers, literacy coaches, and paraprofessionals and reading tutors who conduct small group instruction. Using data from assessments done three times a year through iReading, an online student assessment program, Haynes said Washington had a goal of a 10% improvement in scores by the end of the first year as his first year as principal, which they achieved 2 years in a row. While Washington Elementary School has been seen improvement worthy of recognition by DESE, Haynes said it's an ongoing process which is made more difficult to track with a new set of students every year. The work is never done, he said. The middle school level was the most underrepresented among the list of schools of recognition this year, but the Stoklosa Middle School received the distinction. Stoklosa principal James Cardacci told The Sun Tuesday his school went from 12th percentile in math and English 2 years ago to the 23rd percentile last year and now the 33rd percentile this year. We have had a pretty significant jump against the rest of the state. It was really a good 2 years for us, he said. Cardacci said there was no single thing he could attribute to dramatic improvement for his school, but a number of strategies employed to help the students. One such strategy was using baseline testing for any given subject, Cardacci said, and using the results of that test to build out a plan for a student in that subject for the next 6 weeks. At the end of that cycle, the data for that student would be reviewed and they could be moved to different levels as needed. For this to work, though, Cardacci said, the entire school community had to embrace it. A lot of the school culture and buy-in on the turnaround plan was a big part of that. Our teachers really bought in over the last couple of years, so a lot of credit goes to them and our instructional coaches up and down the line. Cardacci is in his 10th year as principal and said even before the COVID-19 pandemic, which was upended educational progress across the board, Washington Elementary had struggled to get out of the 12th to 17th percentile range for most metrics. Education data from the pandemic, often difficult to discern due to canceled MCAS tests in 2020 and the altered version of the test offered in 2021. Still, Cardacci said in 2021, just 19% of Washington elementary school students received a proficient score in the MCAS exams. Most recently, the number was up to 37%. We just had to deconstruct what we were doing to even get back to the pre-pandemic numbers. And now we have eclipsed and gone significantly past that. The three schools in Lowell Public Schools were not the only ones in Greater Lowell to be recognized by DESE this year. Littleton Middle School was named as National Blue Ribbon School nominee by DESE, while Littleton High School was also named as a school of recognition. In Tewksbury, John W. Wynn Middle School was also a recipient of the School of Recognition distinction from DESE. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. In the Eagle Tribune, Santa Frosty Come A-Calling. Methuen tree lighting brings out holiday spirit. A 30-foot spruce tree adorned with bright lights herald the beginning of the holiday season this weekend. On Sunday, the city held its annual Christmas tree lighting at the Loop, 90 Pleasant Valley Street. Along with food, a horse-drawn wagon, pony rides, games, and the Methuen tree lighting chorus brought an extra ounce of Christmas cheer. More than 100 families joined the festivities alongside Mayor DJ Beauregard and the chorus composed of dozens of local students. The tree was courtesy of the Methuen Senior Activity Center, and Santa himself was present, as well as Frosty the Snowman. Pony rides were provided by Hunter Haven Farm in Groveland. That's it. Back to you.
Okay. Workplace safety. DPH issues stone dust disease alert. Wow. A longtime worker in the stone countertop industry has been diagnosed with a devastating life-altering disease as state officials alert employers. The Massachusetts Department of Public Health is warning those in stone countertop fabrication industry to protect workers from silica dust exposure after the first confirmed case of silicosis. The preventable yet incurable and progressive lung disease is caused by inhaling crystalline silica, which is found naturally in granite and other stones. The state's first confirmed case associated with occupational exposure in this industry was recently diagnosed in a man in his 40s. For the past 14 years, he had worked for two stone countertop fabrication and installation companies in the Bay State. His work involving cutting and shaping quartz, granite, marble, and porcelain. He reported that the workplace at the first company was very dusty. Wet methods were not routinely used, and he was given thin surgical masks to wear when performing job duties. After about 10 years with that company, he started experiencing cough and shortness of breath. These symptoms persisted, and 4 years later, after several medical visits, and tests, he was diagnosed with silicosis. He was also experiencing fatigue and weight loss. While this is the state's first confirmed case of silicosis among this workforce, the growing number of cases recently reported in other states and countries linked to this industry suggests that additional unconfirmed cases could exist in Massachusetts. Silicosis is a devastating, life-altering disease and one that is also absolutely preventable, said Public Health Commissioner Robbie Goldstein. Massachusetts employers and industries where workers are exposed to silica dust have a responsibility to protect their workforce, including from harmful airborne dust, Goldstein added. No worker should have to suffer from a chronic and insidious lung disease or possibly die because of a preventable exposure at work. There's a long latency period between silica exposure and the development of silicosis. Silicosis is an often disabling and sometimes fatal disease that is characterized by scarring of the lungs. Each symptom includes an irritating cough, mucus, and shortness of breath. As the disease progresses, people may have difficulty breathing and can experience fatigue, chest pain, leg swelling, and bluish lips. There's no cure for silicosis, but exposure to silica dust can be minimized through proper workplace controls. The confirmation of this case in Massachusetts is a tragic reminder that silicosis is not just a distant threat. It is here, and it's seriously impacting the health of workers in Massachusetts, said Emily Sparrow-Fine, director of DPH's Occupational Health Surveillance Program. Beyond the critical role employers play, everyone involved in the supply chain, from consumers and designers to contractors, can help reduce the danger by opting for materials that contain less silica and pose fewer health hazards. Workers in other industries, such as construction and masonry, might also be at risk of the exposure to silica dust when working with silica containing construction materials such as sand, stone, concrete, brick, or mortar. By issuing the safety alert, DPH's Occupational Health Surveillance Program is sounding the alarm to raise awareness among employers in Massachusetts about the hazards of silica and how to protect their workers' health and safety. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. In the Tribune, town police settle whistleblower lawsuit. Female sergeant complained of sexual harassment, retaliation, discrimination in North Andover. A second female officer has settled with the police chief and a former town employee after filing a whistleblower lawsuit 3 years ago. Sergeant Catherine Geck came to settlement in mediation with former assistant town manager Denise Casey and police chief Charles Gray over claims of sexual harassment, retaliation, and gender discrimination she claimed she experienced during her time serving the department since 2005. Gerg, who is still employed with the department, and the town filed a joint notice of settlement on November 26, informing the Essex County Superior Court in Newburyport and requested an order for a 30-day waiting period. An agreement for judgment or stipulation of dismissal has been ordered to be filed with the Superior Court by December 26. Girk filed the lawsuit under the state's Civil Rights and Whistleblower Acts in October 2022, alleging the department violated her rights by retaliating against her for reporting, objecting to, and filing complaints about ongoing violations of law, as well as issues related to public safety and health within the department and at the station. Details of the settlement were not available yet. She originally sought $830,000 in lost wages, compensation, and damages. She alleged she was subjected to a pattern of retaliation and discriminatory treatment consisting of ongoing emotional abuse, tolerated and tactically approved by superiors, not limited to Gray. The complaint paints a picture of an unprofessional environment and pranks condoned by its chief. Other allegations detail Girk being passed over for promotions and female officers being treated as inferior in a department. When the lawsuit was filed, the sergeant said the ratio of male to female officers was 40-3. In a Facebook post in September, the North Andover Police Department highlighted its three female officers on National Police Women's Day, including Girk, for the women's strong leadership inside and outside our department walls. She alleged female officers were afforded less opportunities for growth in the department, including moving up the ranks or training. According to her complaint, she also alleged revised terms of the police's collective bargaining agreement with the town and step increases in 2022 adversely affected her as they were changed to years of service to the town and not all years of civil years. She outlined instances where she objected to and raised concerns to Gray and other administration to the condition of the women's locker room, which had mold and actual mushrooms growing in it. According to court documents, she alleged her continued complaints against the department, like speaking out about the women's locker room compared to the men's, unprofessional conduct, and disparate treatment led her to be labeled as a troublemaker by supervisors, including Gray. Girk also claimed she was subjected to retaliation for being an aide to another female officer, former officer Cara Caffrey Rowley, who filed a Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination complaint against Gray for sexual harassment discrimination. Caffrey Rowley settled with the department on her complaint for an undisclosed sum of money. Girk said her support for her fellow female officer negatively impacted Gray's opinion of her. She cited other consequences from questioning departmental decisions making, such as when she suggested separating being the court and firearms officer as part of the duties of the school resource officer, a position she held in 2013, in order to better focus on issues in the schools. She said her recommendations were not well received and she ultimately resigned from the position. But later, some of the duties she suggested were removed from the school resource officer's responsibilities. Girk said Gray began to implement and foster a culture of discriminatory and harassing conduct when he became chief in 2016. During a consultant interview conducted by the town to review the department in October 2020, Girk identified and complained of numerous instances of discriminatory and harassing conduct that she had witnessed and been a victim of personally, according to court papers. She said she sought personal counseling to handle stress from her work after the department refused to provide mental health assistance or critical incident stress management to officers who responded to the 2018 gas disaster. In the same interview, Girk said she told the review committee that when she brought the issue up with Gray about counseling, he responded that it's part of the job. In her complaint, Girk alleged a paper shredder in the department labeled Marie by a male officer after its female animal control officer who resigned in 2018. This was done with the intention of comparing the female officer to trash, according to the lawsuit. She alleged in May 2022 that some male staff members still refer to the machine as Marie. According to her lawsuit, Gray also made comments to Girk about how female officers who file complaints were setting themselves up for a payday. Defense counsel repeatedly filed motions to delay a jury trial. In a pretrial briefing, jointly filed by both parties, Girk was to present evidence that she was illegally discriminated against, while the defense looked to offer evidence to demonstrate Girk's main grievance was actually with the police union in town and the negotiated collective bargaining agreement in 2022. Back to you, Diane.
Okay. My computer logged out. Hold on one second. I have the Welsh trial. DNA evidence in the spotlight. Prosecutors narrowed in on DNA evidence on day 7 of Brian Walsh's trial, with witnesses detailing the process of analyzing samples from its ranging from blood-stained slippers to a hacksaw and a hatchet. The DNA profile from this item is at least 30 nanonillion times more likely if it originated from Anna Walsh than if it originated from an unknown, unrelated individual, and this provides support for inclusion of Anna Walsh to this DNA's profile, said Salman Salim, forensic scientist 3 in the DNA unit at the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab, speaking of a stained area on the blade of a hacksaw. Forensic specialists spoke to the lengthy process of DNA collection and analysis on Tuesday in Norfolk Superior Court, where Brian Walsh stands trial on charges he killed his wife before dismembering and disposing of her body in January of 2023. Brian Walsh pleaded guilty to lying to the investigators when Anna Walsh first disappeared and mishandling her remains ahead of his trial. However, the defense has claimed she died of sudden unexplained death and the husband covered up her death in fear of losing custody of his children. Without a body, prosecutors during the trial have turned to blood and other forensic evidence for details of her death. Witnesses testified Tuesday that evidence supports the conclusion that Anna's DNA was found on several objects. These include stained dark gray slippers, several spots and stains on a Tyvek suit, a lightweight disposable coverall used in activities like painting or cleanup, unknown tissue found in a Swampscott dumpster, samples of red-brown stains on house basement floor, the blade and handle of a hacksaw, a towel with red-brown stains, stained hairs, a rug with red-brown stains, and a hatchet. State Trooper previously testified several of the items, including the Tyvek suit, hatchet, and hacksaw, were found in a Swampscott dumpster and trash compactor where Walsh's phone had been tracked to. Brian Walsh's DNA could be confirmed on several items as well, Salim testified. Evidence of his DNA could be found on a spot on the Tyvek suit and a piece of tape with gauze and a red-brown stain, she said. Defense attorney Larry Tipton pushed back on the process of DNA collection and identification, stirring doubt about how the DNA was deposited, whether other DNA could be present, and more. Based on all of your observations of the data and the results here, once again, you say how many of the biological materials were deposited on any of these items, correct? Tipton said. That's correct, Salim answered. And you cannot tell the jury, and it's the limitation of the DNA testing. You can't tell when it was deposited, correct? Tipton continued before Salim said correct. For instance, if there is a particular object like a tool, let's say a hatchet, you cannot tell from your DNA testing that that hatchet actually ever came in contact with the biological material, Tipton began before the prosecution objected. The prosecution ended the day by calling the district loss prevention manager from Home Goods in the area and playing more videos of Brian Walsh appearing to buy more items like a rug and a bath mat in the days after his wife went missing. The video evidence follows several similar videos shown on day six, including one appearing to show the suspect purchased items like a mop, painter's bucket, rags, 3 64-ounce bottles of ammonia and 5 bottles of hydrogen peroxide in the first days of January 2023. The trial will resume Wednesday at 10 a.m. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. In Eagle Tribune in Methuen, need for council vote of confidence on Kwong questioned. It was during a highly charged and emotional meeting Monday night when City Councilor Nick DiZoglio suggested the council add themselves to a compiled list of failed leadership. That night, the council voted 5-2 on a resolution declaring no confidence in both Superintendent Brandy Kwong and the school committee, which oversees her and the public school district. The resolution, which had blindsided many on the committee, had been added to a meeting on tax classification and resulted in officials airing their grievances with each other before the public with little filter. Many school officials were also befuddled by the call for no confidence in Kwong, as she announced at the beginning of the school year she would be resigning in the summer after 7 years in the role and 2 decades in the district. The motion, sponsored by Councillor Francisco Cirillo, paints a picture of a failing school district with an ever-increasing budget, presided over by toxic and inept leadership. In public participation, school officials challenged many of these assertions, particularly in student achievement, while agreeing that the district continues to struggle, though not uniquely, among peer communities. Councillor Jaina Zanny Pesk, who successfully amended the resolution to include a critique of the committee, said the point of the measure was to set a new directive for new school leadership. "I have no confidence in the system the way it is now," Pesk said. "It's not personal." DiZoglio, who alongside Councillor Joyce Campanone voted against the measure, said while he was also critical of the district, the symbolic vote would only further divide the city. "We are setting no example whatsoever," he said. "Things need to change. That's not our job. That's the school committee's job." A committee meeting had been scheduled for the same time that night, but was canceled, as most, if not all, the members showed up to the council meeting. Committee member Mary Beth Donovan Grassi and others expressed concern that the resolution would make it harder for the district to find a qualified candidate to replace Kwong. "Potential candidates are watching, and I truly wonder who would want to lead our schools when turmoil is being created," she said. She also countered some of the statistics provided in the resolution, including a measure of college readiness that, rather than a broad indicator, was simply a gauge of students' success in advanced placement courses, according to Donovan Grassi. She said the resolution feels unnecessary, politically motivated, and unfortunately mean-spirited. Member Lori Keegan went further and said the document included lies and accusations. However, not all committee members were opposed to the vote. Member Kristen Maxwell, a longtime critic of Kwong, supported the motion and said Kwong's administration has repeatedly failed to address her and others' concerns. Additionally, a few unsuccessful committee candidates asked the council to approve the resolution or to simply take a vote. Alejandro Bees, who lost a bid to serve on the committee in November, urged the council to follow up on campaign promises and hold school officials accountable. Former candidate Maria Figueroa spoke of a toxic work environment caused by the school administration and explained she was there to read a letter by an anonymous school employee who feared retaliation. While co-president of the Methuen Education Association, Cara Blatt, said the meeting and a diversion from the important job of finding a replacement for Kwong. A vote of no confidence does not fight for our students, Blatt said. I urge you tonight to stop the distractions. A few attending parents used the council floor to express concerns related to their children's education and district struggles or failure to provide adequate support to students with more complex needs. The actual debate by the council over the resolution was brief, around 10 minutes, with some counselors asking that the question be moved early on before most had spoken on the matter, including Mayor DJ Beauregard. Kwong has provided few public details on her reason for leaving the district, but in recent months, committee meetings have gotten more tense and abrasive. She is also leaving in the wake of a culture audit of the school, which highlighted criticism of her administration, though solely based on a series of surveys. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I have two short articles. So one's about a shark, which is kind of crazy. The title of it says, Cape Cod Fish Trap, Another Shark Washes Up Dead as Waters Cool. Hopefully sharks are warning each other about the Cape's fish trap. Yet another thresher shark washed up dead on Cape Cod Beach over the weekend. The second shark that was recently found stranded on a bay beach. Local shark researchers responded on Saturday to the 13-foot male shark on Eastman's Campground Beach. This is the time of year we see strandings and water temperatures start to drop and species try to move south only to be drawn into the Cape Cod fish trap. Shark researcher John Chisholm, adjunct scientist in the New England Aquarium, posted after leading the necropsy, which I think is like an autopsy of a creature. It's not coincidence that many of these critters wash up along the beaches on the east side of Cape Cod Bay, he added. The Cape's unique shape and position on the coast essentially turns it into fishware, directing species into the bay where they become trapped. Unfortunately, unlike the cold stunned turtles that are being rescued along the same beaches, sharks need to be in the water to breathe. So once they get stranded, chances of rescue are very low. We do make every effort to save these creatures, and groups like NECWA, New England Coastal Wildlife Alliance, go above and beyond with their support efforts. So if you come across a stranded individual, please report it, he added. The sooner someone can respond, the better the chance for survival. A joint team from the New England Coastal Wildlife Alliance and the New England Aquarium at Atlantic White Shark Conservancy were able to gather data from the shark. With guidance from NOAA Fisheries, Michelle Passerotti, samples were collected for further analysis. Although it is very sad to see such a beautiful animal stranded along our shores, this is a great opportunity for our interns and volunteers as a learning experience, NECWA posted. And the photos, data, and tissues collected from this carcass will help scientists better understand this unusual species. Then a totally unrelated but quick article. The Fall River Deadly Fire. Assisted living facility owner inspector sues each other over faulty sprinklers. This was, I think, about a year ago, this fire, or over the summer. A safety inspection company and the owner of Massachusetts assisted living facility was the site of a fire in July that killed 10 people are blaming each other for failing to address a faulty sprinkler system. Inspector Fire Systems, Inc. sued Gabriel House owner Dennis Etzcorn, claiming it notified the facility months before the fire about recalled sprinklers that needed to be replaced. Etzcorn filed a cross-claim on Monday alleging that Fire Systems, Inc. had failed for years to properly inspect and test the sprinklers at Gabriel House. The fire in Fall River was the state's deadliest in more than four decades. Documents obtained by the Associated Press showed a history of troubles at the facility, including a period in which it was barred from accepting new residents until it corrected problems with residential treatment. Investigators have said the cause of the fire was unintentional and may have originated with someone smoking or an electrical issue with an oxygen machine. Questions surfaced following the fire about whether the facility's sprinkler system functioned properly. Fire Systems Incorporated said in a statement that in September of 2024, one of its inspectors did identify fire sprinkler heads installed at Gabriel House that had been the subject of a manufacturer recall and might not operate in the event of a fire. That's all in quotes. Gabriel House's court filing stated, in quotes, a result of the failure of the sprinkler system at Gabriel House to function properly, the fire and the resulting heat and smoke from the fire were not contained to that one room and spread throughout the facility, end quote. It said Gabriel House anticipated that Fire Systems, Inc. would try to shift responsibility to the facility for failing to replace the sprinklers. Fire Systems, Inc. maintains that it appropriately notified Gabriel House of potential problems with the sprinklers, said Todd Fogarty, a spokesperson for the company. FSI promptly notified the Gabriel House in writing about the need to replace the recalled sprinkler heads and offered a complimentary survey to develop a replacement quote. Gabriel House, however, did not act on FSI's notification, Fogarty said in a statement Tuesday. The facility has been the subject of lawsuits from residents in the aftermath of the fire. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. Back to the Eagle Tribune in Haverhill. Haverhill thinks ahead to America's 250th anniversary. Even though Christmas lights and holiday wreaths are just now being strung and hung, Haverhill's patriots in planning have jumped ahead to July for a tribute to America's 250th birthday. With the United States semi-quincentennial, or the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution, is only 6 months away, local leaders are mapping out how Haverhill will honor the history of its founding, from fireworks over their Merrimack to a chugging history train and maybe even a life-sized hologram of George Washington himself. The newly assembled Haverhill 250th Anniversary Monthly Planning Committee held its kickoff meeting on Friday to discuss the details of the big day, but member E. Philip Brown said that they're still in very early stage brainstorming. Organized by Mayor Melinda Barrett, this committee will lay the groundwork for the citywide observance, chaired by Downtown Events Coordinator Haley Pearson. Other members of the committee include Community Development Division Director Andrew Hurley, Historic New England's Marilyn Keith Daly, and Kraft Haverhill's Jimmy Carbone. Brown, a public historian and former Haverhill High School teacher, said the group is weighing whether the celebration should take the form of a single signature event, a week-long extravaganza, a month of programming, or events throughout the year, with July 4 falling on a Saturday. There was a strong interest in pairing one signature event with multiple smaller neighborhood-based activities to encourage broad community participation, he said. Greater Haverhill Chamber of Commerce President Katie Cook, also on the committee, said that the committee is leaning toward modeling the celebration around the Declaration of Independence. The committee intends to highlight Haverhill's revolutionary roots and underused sites across the city. Locations like Riverside Park for fireworks, downtown Haverhill, Harbor Place, G.A.R. Park, the Whittier Birthplace, Tattersall Farm, historic New England properties, and neighborhood parks were all discussed. Potential programming includes a public Declaration of Independence reading on or around July 1st. multi-generational activities and youth competitions, a history train in collaboration with Buttonwoods Museum and Merrimack Valley Transit, film screenings such as 1776, faith-based history tours, and trivia nights with questions on local and revolutionary history. Brown noted that the Haverhill High School class of 1976 may host a revolution-themed trivia contest as part of the anniversary. AHEPA Acropolis Chapter 39 has purchased a life-size hologram display system capable of displaying figures like George Washington. The hologram is expected to appear at multiple public locations throughout the celebration before being donated to Haverhill Public Schools for future educational use. Early discussions have referenced an estimated cost of roughly $20,000 in addition to fireworks and public safety, but fundraising and sponsorships will shape the final budget. In March, the Haverhill City Council approved a transfer to the city's free cash reserve, which included a $100,000 allocation to the summer celebration. At that time, officials targeted Friday, July 3, as the date of the main event, mentioning fireworks and a drone show. At the City Council meeting, Barrett said that fireworks alone could cost the city about $35,000. Subcommittees were formed for programming, logistics, marketing, and fundraising budgeting at Friday's meeting. The full committee will reconvene at 9 a.m. on the first Friday of each month. Across all discussions, the shared goal is to build civic pride and use the 250th anniversary as an opportunity to bring the community together and celebrate Haverhill's history in meaningful and inclusive ways, Brown said. Last month, Brown shared test projections of an anniversary logo, not yet official, which he displayed on buildings like the Dustin Garrison House, Clement Farmhouse, and Cogswell Art Space. The logo features a silhouette of a soldier with a rifle standing before a red 250 and with the words Haverhill above and Anniversary of American Revolution below. Two Haverhill nonprofits, Historic New England and the Museum of Printing, also received part of a $1.5 million statewide grant packaged in September by the Massachusetts 250 Grant Program. The grants, announced by the Healy Driscoll administration, are intended to support semi-quincentennial programming across the state. Historic New England received $25,000 to promote and expand its revolutionary era programming across its 22 Massachusetts properties. The Museum of Printing received $7,500 for Revolution Then and Now, a series of exhibits, lectures, demonstrations, and events highlighting printing and handbills during the Revolution. The next meeting of the Haverhill 250th Anniversary Committee is scheduled for the first Friday of next month. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I have Merrimack Valley in a minute, and then we're going to take our break. Out of Lowell, Elevate New England celebrated the achievements of 90 students who were newly certified in its Teach Back program on December 5th, one of the largest groups to date. The nonprofit works to build long-term, life-changing relationships with New England's urban youth, equipping them to thrive and contribute to their communities. Through Elevate's classes and mentoring, teens learn responsibility, leadership, communication, and resilience. Certification marks the moment that they're ready to take what they learned and bring it to the Lowell and Lawrence Elementary Schools, teaching once a week throughout the next semester. Elevate New England continues to advance its mission. No young person should have to work toward their goals alone. For more information, email elevatenewengland.org or Rhea, spelled R-H-E-A, at elevatenewengland.org. Out of Westford, aspiring comedians 18 and over can take the stage for 5 minutes at the Parish Center for the Arts during the comedy open mic night, Saturday, December 13th, which is this Saturday, from 7:30 to 10 p.m., 10 Lincoln Street. Host Julie Wesner will introduce 12 local stand-up acts of Sarah Levy, Satish Bhatt, Jean DeRosa, Sean Stiles, Pete McLaughlin, I.J. Thacker, A. Weiss Hussein, Katie Farrell, Glenn Mosley, Kristen Gigi Fall, Justin George, Jeremy Tamelio, Matt Rogers, Mike DuPont, Ian Sargent, Freddie Scabelli, Brian Cassidy, and Shira Kieserman. Sign-ups are closed for this event, but the public is welcome to enjoy the show. Admission is $5, and that's a donation. Remaining comedy open mic dates include February 7th with host Ryan Russell and June 20th with host Jenny Fitz. For more information about the PCA's comedy open mic nights, call 978-692-6333. All right, out of Lowell, the Boston Pops Esplanade Orchestra performs the music of the Christmas season on December 14th at 2:30 at the Lowell Memorial Auditorium, 50 East Merrimack Street. The orchestra performs holiday classics, the traditional Pops sing-along of carols, and new arrangements of seasonal favorites, including A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. The Pops are joined by the Metropolitan Chorale, known as one of the Metro Boston's premier choral ensembles. Santa Claus will make a guest appearance during the concert's finale. Tickets range from $55 to $178. For more information, call 800-657-8774. And lastly, Winter Coat Donation Drive. Caring Partners Coats for Kids and Families is accepting donations of winter coats for children and adults in need until Saturday, January 10th. New England's largest coat drive collects gently used coats of all sizes, especially extra large and infant through pre-K sizes, and for all ages at all Anton Cleaners, Jordan's Furniture, and Rockland Trust locations. The coats are professionally cleaned by Anton's and distributed via local nonprofits, social service agencies, and schools. The goal of this year's drive is to collect 50,000 warm coats for those in need. The program has collected, cleaned, and distributed nearly 1,275,912 free coats at more than 70 collection locations and events since the program began in 1995. School groups, corporations, communities, neighborhoods, and individuals are welcome to donate coats for children and adults at Anton's Cleaners, Jordan's Furniture, Rockland Trust Bank locations. Each year, more than 200 school groups are responsible for half of all the coats collected. For more information about participating or donating, visit antons.com. And on that note, we will take our morning break. We will return shortly, and we thank you for listening thus far. We are back, and you are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank you, Mass Lowell's WUML-FM, for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Okay, we're going to move out of local news for a moment and go into Washington. Hegseth tells congressional leaders he's weighing release of a boat strike video. Out of Washington, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told congressional leaders Tuesday that he was still weighing whether to release the full video of an attack on an alleged drug boat that killed two survivors, even as he faced intensifying demands from Congress for disclosure. Hegseth provided a classified briefing for congressional leaders alongside Secretary of State Marco Rubio and CIA Director John Ratcliffe at the Capitol. Inside the secure room, Senate Democrat leader Chuck Schumer asked the defense secretary whether he should allow every member of Congress to view the video of the attack from September. Schumer said Hegseth's response was, "We have to study it." Lawmakers are demanding a full accounting from the Department of Defense on the military campaign and the particular attack that killed two people who were clinging to the wreckage of an initial strike. Legal experts say that action may have violated the laws governing the use of deadly military force. The situation has awakened the Republican-controlled Congress to its oversight role after months of frustration about the trickle of information from the Pentagon. Schumer described the briefing as very unsatisfying and added that Democrats and Republicans had a right to see it, wanted to see it, and should see it. Separately Tuesday, the U.S. Naval Admiral, who is retiring early from command of the campaign to destroy vessels allegedly carrying drugs near Venezuela, spoke to key lawmakers overseeing the U.S. military. The classified video called between Admiral Alvin Holsley, who will be retiring from U.S. Southern Command in the coming days, and the GOP chair and ranking Democrat of the Senate Armed Services Committee, represented another determined step by lawmakers to get answers about the operation. Senator Roger Wicker, the Republican chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, declined to discuss the specifics of the call, but described Holsley as a great public servant. He also said that the Pentagon is weighing whether releasing the video would disclose classified information, of course. In its annual defense authorization bill, which was crafted by both Republicans and Democrats, Congress is demanding that the Pentagon turn over unedited videos of the strike, as well as the orders authorizing the attack. The legislation threatens to uphold a quarter of Hegseth's travel budget if he refuses. There is a growth demand that everyone get a right in the Senate to see it, said Senator Jack Reed, the top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee. He added that Holsley answered the senator's questions, but also said that there's still many questions to be answered. Reed later added that Holsley did not give a reason for his retirement other than saying it was a personal decision. Lawmakers are trying to understand the purpose and parameters of President Donald Trump's campaign, which has struck 22 boats and killed at least 87 people since it started in September. Trump has also been making threats against Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, sending a fleet of warships near the South American country, including the largest U.S. Air Force carrier. On Tuesday, the U.S. military flew a pair of fire jets over the Gulf of Venezuela in what appeared to be the closest American warplanes have come to the country's airspace since the start of President Trump's administrative pressure campaign. Holsley became the leader of the U.S. Southern Command just over 1 year ago, but in October, Hegseth announced that Holsley would be retiring early from his post. As commander of U.S. forces in the region, Holsley oversaw a command structure that has in recent years been mostly focused on building stability and cooperation across much of the region. Trump's drug boat campaign, however, has added a new deadly dynamic to its mission. Rather than trying to interdict drug-carrying vessels as forces like the U.S. Coast Guard have traditionally done, the Trump administration asserts that the drugs and drug smugglers are posing a direct threat to American lives. Officials say they are applying the same rules as the global war on terror to kill drug smugglers. Trump this weekend justified the strike by claiming that the two suspected drug smugglers were trying to right the part of the boat after it had capsized in the initial attack. However, Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley, the special operations commander who ordered the second strike, told lawmakers in a closed-door briefing last week that he ordered the second strike to ensure that the cocaine in the boat could not be picked up later by cartel members. The entire House Armed Services Committee will also hear from Bradley next week, said Representative Adam Smith, the top Democrat on the panel. We need an all-member briefing for the House of Representatives, House Democrat leader Hakeem Jeffries told the Associated Press. For the last several months, the Trump administration has brandished videos of the strikes, black and white footage of boats exploding into flames on social media. Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, called it a little strange for officials to now claim that full, unedited videos of the strike is classified and cannot be released even to the members of Congress. We got a little pushback, said Representative Jim Hines, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. You acknowledge potential concerns over disclosing sources and methods used in the strikes, but we said, look, you're posting every time we take a strike. You post it. The Democrats also said that the logic underpinning the entire operation is deeply problematic. They're using expensive, exquisite American military capabilities to kill people who are the equivalent of corner dealers, said Chris Coons, a Delaware Democrat. Hold on one second. Lawmakers are also questioning, excuse me, what intelligence the military is using to determine, excuse me, what the boat's cargo is headed for the U.S. As they have looked closer at the September 2nd strike, excuse me, lawmakers learned that the destroyed boat was heading south at the time of the attack, and that military intelligence showed it was heading towards another vessel that was bound for Suriname. Still, it remains to be seen whether the Republican-controlled Congress will push back on the Trump administration's campaign. Many have so far stood behind it, but worry is also growing about the prospect of war. House Speaker Mike Johnson missed the classified briefing, the only leader to do so, according to two people familiar with the private session who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Johnson's absence was notable from the speaker, who is second in line of succession to the president, especially as Congress is expected to have the final say in the military's use of the nation's war powers. War powers resolution vote. A group of senators, three Democrats and one Republican, is also preparing to force a vote on the legislation as soon as next week that would halt Trump's ability to use military force against Venezuela directly without congressional approval. The senators have already tried unsuccessfully to pass a similar resolution, but also Republicans voted against it. However, the senators say there is now renewed interest from GOP lawmakers. These follow on strikes of people who are wounded in the ocean is really against our code of military justice, said Senator Rand Paul, the Kentucky Republican who was sponsoring the legislation. They are illegal, he said. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. In the Eagle Tribune, board approves permit for controversial 200-unit development. Methuen concerned about traffic increase. In Methuen, officials are expecting an increase in traffic along Wheeler Street with the approval of a large housing project. The Dragut Zoning Board of Appeals last week approved a permit for a controversial 200-unit developmental located off the road in West Methuen, but still within the town line of Dragut. The unanimous decision by board members cap off years of debate and negotiations over the project that was at one point proposed as a 300-unit, four-bedroom-each project. While many in Dragut opposed the 33-acre project over the theoretical impact it could have on enrollment in the school district, Methuen officials, including Mayor D.J. Beauregard, pointed to the potential for an increase in traffic on city roads. While the approved permit contains a number of conditions related to traffic, Beauregard said the project is still unacceptable. Conditions include requirements to maintain sight lines at intersections, as well as other measures within the city. Despite opposition to the project in both communities, Dragut town officials maintained they had little ability to overly constrain the project, as the contractor has the ability to appeal to the state and override town controls through affordable housing regulations, resulting in fewer conditions or constraints. Officials approved a permit which slimmed down the total number of bedrooms from potentially 1,200 to 400. It's unclear if the developer plans to appeal the town's decision. I don't think that we should collectively decide against 200 units because we are worried about litigation. Draket ZBA member Nicholas Jarek said, it's our job here to do what is best, and if the state disagrees, that's a problem down the road. Despite the fewer number of total units, the approved permit lays out a project with the same density as the 300-unit plan, owing to a reduction in the number of acres by the developer. The project will also require the city of Methuen to allow the developer certain easements. The project is being overseen by the Homes at Murphy's Farm, an LLC registered to Andover-based developer Kevin O'Brien. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I have a short but sweet little story. Food brings people together. Heather Brody Perry turns community food stories into a cookbook. Out of Ashby. When the Ashby Free Public Library experienced a flood, director Heather Brody Perry had an idea. She would write a cookbook. At the time, the library was hosting programs that encouraged healthy eating, including sharing vegetable recipes through the North Central Community Foundation and Harvest Ashby's Health Grant, and a long-running family cooking club. With a gluten-free director, several gluten-free trustees, and gluten-free library kids, the library had become a hub of recipe sharing and creative cooking. A cookbook felt like a natural next step, Perry said. My book, Food Brings People Together, collects recipes from the community alongside stories of the moments when food brought people closer. Perry hoped that the cookbook would raise a small amount of money to support building repairs at the library. Ashby had created several cookbooks in the past, many of which are still available at the library, said Perry. Thanks to modern print-on-demand services, producing this latest cookbook required virtually no financial outlay. Residents and former Ashby friends can purchase the book to enjoy a taste of their hometown while supporting a good cause. Perry describes the cookbook as a part recipe collection, part guidebook for small libraries looking to engage their communities. She shares stories of learning on the job as a new library director in Ashby, finding ways to make things work, sometimes with little more than imagination and community spirit, she added. Part cookbook, part little engine that could. Food Brings People Together is a celebration of the power of food and the power of community. It is my hope that this brings people together, supports a small library, and creates memories that last a lifetime, Perry said with a smile. For more information or to purchase the cookbook, please visit Amazon.com or AshburyLibrary.org. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. Back to the Eagle Tribune. New Hampshire keeps vaccine schedule despite RFK change. New Hampshire parents will still be able to get their newborns life-saving vaccines against hepatitis B, despite U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s efforts to curb the practice, according to a memo the New Hampshire Health Alert sent to medical providers Friday. The alert, part of the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services, wasn't sent to the general public, reiterating the medical value of the hepatitis B vaccine as the state continues to recommend the shots despite federal changes. Last week, the Federal Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices voted to stop recommending the hepatitis B vaccine for newborns. Kennedy, a vaccine skeptic, who made millions for his anti-vaccine advocacy, replaced the public health officials on the ACIP this summer with people who share his discredited theories. When asked about the alert to medical providers Friday, Maddie Miller, public health information officer, responded Monday. Please see the statement below attributed to state epidemiologist Dr. Benjamin Chan. The New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS, is aware of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, vote to no longer universally recommend the hepatitis B vaccine for all infants and children. DHHS and leading expert medical organizations such as the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Family Physicians continue to recommend hepatitis B vaccination for all children, with the first dose given within 24 hours after birth, as the best way to protect kids against hepatitis B and the lifelong health problems it can cause. The department will continue to monitor the impacts of the ACIP decision to ensure New Hampshire families that want the hepatitis B vaccine have access to it. DHHS encourages anyone with questions about any vaccine to speak to a trusted healthcare provider. When asked why the public wasn't told, she didn't immediately respond. Hepatitis B is an incurable disease that can result in liver cancer, cirrhosis, and early death. About half the people with hepatitis B do not know they have it, and the disease is passed on by coming into contact with fluids like blood, saliva. The virus can live on a surface for up to a week, and unvaccinated children who come into contact with that surface can then be infected. Children are susceptible to contracting the disease playing sports, in daycare settings, or from a parent who has an undiagnosed case. About 25% of children who contract the disease will die from it. Before infant vaccinations became common 30 years ago, there were 18,000 children infected every year. Half of the childhood cases are the result of mother-to-child transmission, but that transmission can be stopped by giving the vaccine to newborns. If you have a cut, that blood could potentially get on the infant, Anita Patel, a pediatrician and pediatric critical care physician in Washington, D.C., told the Associated Press. And if that infant has any sort of break in their skin, as infants, frankly, frequently do, they can then get hepatitis B, Kennedy retired, the 17 medical and technical experts on the ACIP soon after he took office. The new members announced in June include Vicki Pebsworth, a regional director for the National Association of Catholic Nurses. She has been listed as a board member and volunteer director for the National Vaccine Information Center, a group that is widely considered to be a leading source of vaccine misinformation, according to the AP. Back to you, Diane.
All right, I have today in history. In 1861, the Confederacy admitted Kentucky as its recognized a pre-Southern shadow state government that was acting without the authority of the pro-Union government in Frankfurt. In 1898, a treaty was signed in Paris, officially ending the Spanish-American War. In 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt became the first American to win a Nobel Peace Prize, winning the Nobel Peace Prize for helping to negotiate peace in the Russo-Japan War. In 1964, Martin Luther King Jr. received his Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, saying he accepted it with an abiding faith in America and an audacious faith in the future of mankind. In 1967, singer Otis Redding, 26, and six others were killed when their plane crashed into a Wisconsin lake. Trumpeter Ben Cawley, a member of the group The Barkays, was the only survivor. In 1999, Yasser Arafat, Simone Peres, and Yitzhak Rabin was jointly awarded the Nobel Prize for their efforts to advance the Middle East peace process. In 2007, former Vice President Al Gore accepted the Nobel Peace Prize with a call to confront human-caused climate change and stop waging war on the environment. In 2021, a two-day outbreak of tornadoes in the U.S. Midwest and South killed more than 90 people across five states, including 77 in Kentucky. The National Weather Service recorded more than 40 twisters from December 10th through December 11th. On 2023, Morocco, I'm sorry, 2022, Morocco became the first African country to reach the World Cup semifinals by beating Portugal 1-0. Today's birthdays, actor Finolu Flanagan, is 84. Actor-singer Gloria Loring is 79. Republic Senator John Boozman of Arkansas is 75. Actor Susan Day is 73. Jazz musician Diane Schur is 72. Actor-director Kenneth Branagh is 65. Actor Nia Peoples is 64. TV chef Bobby Flay is 61. Rock musician Megan White is 51. Actor Emmanuel Kriku is 50. Actor Raven Simone is 40. Actor-singer Tanya Taylor is 35. Actor Kiki Lyon is 34. And cyclist Jonas Vennegaard is 29. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. In the Eagle Tribune, YDC Child Abuse Settlement Fund tops $237 million. Claims Administrator John Broderick is gone, but the Sununun Youth Services Center Settlement Fund's work continues as total claims awarded now exceeds $237 million. The YDC Settlement Fund issued its quarterly report since Broderick left his post this summer, showing 2,269 claims have been filed by the adult supervisors of childhood abuse by state employees. The fund is currently operating without anyone staffing the top claims administrator post. New Hampshire is not covered by insurance for the abuse claims, and taxpayers will ultimately shoulder the financial burden created by decades of abuse and cover-up by YDC employees. The $237 million total for 419 resolved claims as of November 30 includes interest for claims paid in installments. There are still 1,697 claims pending resolution, representing a potential $2 billion liability for taxpayers. Victims had until June 30 of this year to file a claim with the settlement fund or take the state to court. Since the abuse scandal became public in 2020, there has been just one civil trial brought by a survivor, David Meehan. Meehan was awarded $38 million by a jury, but that amount is currently being disputed by the New Hampshire Attorney General's office. The state argues it should only pay Meehan $475,000 after YDC employees raped him hundreds of times while he was a child in state custody. Broderick, the retired New Hampshire Supreme Court Chief Justice, stopped his work in July after Governor Kelly Ayotte pushed through changes to the way the fund operates. Ayotte's changes stripped Broderick's ability to work independently and took away his authority to make final offers to the victims. Whoever takes over Broderick's role will answer to Ayotte instead of the Supreme Court, under the new rules put in place July 1st. The next claims administrator won't have final say in settlement offers, as Broderick did either. Ayotte's changes include giving Attorney General John Formella veto power over settlement offers, according to the quarterly report. 8 settlement agreements were vetoed by Formella between July 1st and November 30. The report also states that 77 claims have been withdrawn from the settlement fund process, allowing those survivors to bring their complaints to court. Under the terms of the settlement fund application process, survivors are required to put their civil lawsuits on hold in order to seek a settlement. If those survivors withdraw from the fund process and go back to court, their case schedules restart, putting them years behind where they were before applying for a settlement. Ayotte's settlement fund changes are currently subject to a lawsuit brought by survivors who claim she pulled a bait and switch on them. Formella negotiated with attorneys for the survivors to get them to encourage clients to seek settlements rather than lawsuits. Broderick's independence from political pressure and his ability to make final offers was a big selling point for the survivors, according to the lawsuit. After the vast majority of survivors opted for the settlement fund by the June 30 deadline, IOTE's changes went into effect on July 1st. Back to you, Diane.
Okay. Trump threatens funding for Chicago after a woman set on fire. President Donald Trump's administration is threatening to pull federal funding for public transportation in Chicago unless the city tightens security after a man allegedly set a woman on fire inside a commuter train in November. Federal Transit Authority Administrator Mark Molinaro sent a letter to Mayor Brandon Johnson and Governor J.B. Pritzker demanding the Chicago Transit Authority develop and implement an updated safety plan by December 19th. The letter did not call for any special changes. The demand comes after a man riding a Blue Line L commuter train on November 17th doused fellow passenger Bethany McGee with gasoline from a plastic drink bottle as she sat with her back to him, according to court filings. He then chased her through the train car and set her on fire. The man got off the train at the next stop in downtown Chicago and walked away as McGee, 26, stumbled out and fell to the ground. She suffered severe burns but survived. Police arrested 50-year-old Lawrence Reed of Chicago the next morning. Federal prosecutors charged him with committing a terrorist act, which carries a maximum sentence of life. Online court records did not list any attorney for him. Information provided to the Associated Press by the Cook County Circuit Court shows more than 60 criminal cases filed against Reed since 1993, ranging from traffic, trespassing, and drug possession of offenses to more serious charges involving violent behavior, including at least 15 battery and assault cases and at least 2 arson cases. At the time of the train attack, Reed was on electronic monitoring in an active battery case. Authorities said he hit a hospital social worker in the face in August. The Cook County Chief Judge's office pointed to state law that strictly limits judges from denying the release of defendants ahead of their trials. Molinaro said in his letter that this was unconscionable, that Reed was released in the battery case and the attack on McGee reflects systemic failures in both leadership and accountability on all levels that cannot be tolerated. I will not accept the brutal assault of an innocent 26-year-old woman as inevitable cost of providing public transportation, he wrote. Asked for comment, Chicago Transit Authority officials responded with an email saying the agency has received the letter and will respond within the requested timeline. The email did not elaborate. The AP also left messages on the mayor and governor's office on Tuesday. Chicago and other Democratic-led cities have been the focus of intense criticism from Trump and his administration, who have characterized them as crime-ridden despite steep drops in violent crime after a pandemic-era spike. The administration in October announced it was withholding $2.1 billion for Chicago infrastructure projects, including expansion plans for the Red Line L commuter train. The project would have established stops in some of the city's poorest neighborhoods. White House budget officials said then that they wanted to ensure funding wasn't moving through race-based contracting. The administration withheld $18 billion for New York infrastructure the same week. Pritzker has long been one of Trump's loudest critics. The president's crackdown on immigrants in Chicago has only heightened tensions. Pritzker has resisted Trump's National Guard deployment, and Trump called the governor a fat slob during his ceremonial Thanksgiving turkey pardons. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you. Another article on the hepatitis B vaccine, this time in Mass. Mass leaders criticize dangerous hepatitis B vaccine guidelines. State House reporter. In Boston, Bay State leaders are criticizing a decision by federal health officials to end the decades-long recommendation that babies get a hepatitis B vaccine within 24 hours of being born. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which provides recommendations to the health agency, voted 8-3 Friday to end the federal government's long-standing policy on the vaccine. Currently, the CDC recommends babies get vaccinated for hepatitis B in the first hours of life, then again when they are 1 to 2 months old, and finally at 6 to 18 months. State and public health leaders are decrying the panel's news recommendation. A panel composed of members all appointed by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longstanding vaccine skeptic who was tapped this year by President Donald Trump to lead the federal health agency. Governor Maura Healey called the vote by Kennedy's hand-picked advisory board dangerous and wrong, and said state health officials will continue to recommend that newborns receive the hepatitis B vaccine. This is about the health and safety of our children. The hepatitis B vaccine is safe, effective, and life-saving, Healey said in a statement. We are going to continue to work with other states to ensure that all of our residents can receive the vaccines they need and want to keep them and their children healthy. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey said the panel's move puts children at risk of chronic liver disease, liver cancer, or death from this incredibly contagious disease. This reckless decision is based on a willful misunderstanding of how vaccines work, and it is intended to sow doubt in one of this country's greatest public health successes, the Mauldin Democrat said, allowing anti-science conspiracy theorists to deny children life-saving vaccines is profoundly immoral and dangerous. In June, Kennedy fired the entire 17-member panel and replaced it with a group that includes several anti-vaccine voices. Hepatitis B is a viral infection that attacks the liver and can lead to serious life long-term health problems, including chronic liver disease, cirrhosis, and liver cancer. Because the virus can be passed from an infected mother to the baby during birth, newborns are at particular risk of developing lifelong infection, state health officials say. The move by the CDC's advisory committee reverses a decades-old recommendation that all babies be vaccinated against hepatitis B right after birth. The shots are considered a major public health accomplishment that have prevented thousands of cases of liver infections. The new recommendations call for the birth dose only for babies whose mothers have tested positive for hepatitis B or haven't been tested for the illness prior to childbirth. For other babies, it will be up to the parents and their doctors to decide if a birth dose is appropriate. The groups also recommended that families who choose to wait for the vaccination series should begin when the child is 2 months old. Ahead of the panel's vote, the State Department of Public Health issued new guidelines more than a week ago that recommend a hepatitis B vaccine birth dose within 24 hours of a child's delivery and completion of the full series within the first 18 months of life. Removing the newborn hepatitis B vaccine from the routine schedule is a decision driven by ideology, not science, and it ignores decades of irrefutable evidence that this dose saves lives, DPH Commissioner Robbie Goldstein said in a statement. Turning away from a proven life-saving intervention puts infants at unnecessary risk and undermines the very foundation of evidence-based public health. He added that, despite this misguided decision, the hepatitis B birth dose will remain available in Massachusetts, and the Department of Public Health continues to strongly recommend that every newborn receive a dose just after birth. Major health advocacy organizations also pushed back on the move, saying it will create confusion among expecting parents and could ultimately cost lives. Dr. Tom Frieden, former CDC director and president and CEO of Resolve to Save Lives, said the panel's recommendation puts millions of American children at greater risk of liver damage, cancer, and early death. Now, obstetricians, pediatricians, insurers, state health departments, and others should stand up for fact-based care, protect our children, and not mess with success, not accept this misguided and dangerous recommendation, Friedman said in a statement. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I've got a commentary. Forced encampments criminalize unhoused. In early September, officials in Utah announced a plan to build an encampment just outside Salt Lake City, where up to 1,300 people experiencing homelessness would be forced to receive treatment for mental health challenges. Unhoused people who refuse to stay in this state's run facility could instead end up in jail. Forcing people to relocate to a facility described by its advocates as a homeless campus, is a violation of their civil liberties. To make matters worse, this approach is generally ineffective and prone to bias. Research shows that involuntary commitment disproportionately affects people of color and disabled people. And in many cases, the care provided to those involuntarily committed is not sufficient to meet their mental health needs. Already, forced psychiatric hospitalizations occur at the same rate as incarceration in the United States. Yet there is no evidence to suggest the health benefits of coerced treatment outweighs the harms, such as increased suicide risk after release. Pouring government dollars into this practice will perpetuate the cycle of criminalization, substance use, and housing insecurity in which many survivors of voluntary treatment become trapped. Construction of the facility will cost roughly $75 million, and yearly operating expenses are estimated at $34 million. It's unclear who will oversee the encampment, who will provide the care services, and what the total cost per patient might look like. However, there are similar examples of detention centers expanding in recent history, as immigration and custom enforcement have ramped up its attacks on immigrants this year, for nonprofit businesses have stepped in to meet the demand, making billions from operating detention centers. It's likely that private entities will do the same for this new type of detention center in Utah. The move to build such encampment signals a renewed effort on the part of local and federal officials to disappear the unhoused. It is consistent with an executive order issued by President Donald Trump in July, which explicitly called for displacing people experiencing homelessness into long-term institutional settings. As a result of the U.S. Supreme Court 2024 ruling in Grant Pass versus Jackson, local and state governments now have greater authority to jail, ticket, or otherwise criminalize homeless people. Since then, according to the American Civil Liberties Union, more than 320 bills that criminalize homelessness have been introduced nationwide, and nearly 220 have passed into law. Bills criminalizing homelessness on the state level often include the same components: a ban on camping with penalties of up to $5,000 and 1 month in jail, a diversion of all federal and state funding for homeless services from permanent housing and supportive services to short-term state-run encampments and emergency shelters, and lowering of due process protections to involuntarily commit people to state psychiatric institutions. These policies mirror the approach taken by the Utah lawmakers. In addition to disseminating the rights of people experiencing homelessness, the Trump administration has threatened federal funding for permanent support housing and rapid rehousing. A recent proposed change would limit the amount of federal funding that communities could invest in solutions that provide housing before treatment. The administration estimates the change would put more than 170,000 people at risk of experiencing homelessness. At the root of these developments is an ugly truth. The widespread societal stigma towards people experiencing homelessness, mental health, and substance use influences lawmakers and the policies they enact, creating an entirely new carceral system for people experiencing homelessness at the state level using federal dollars could create harm instead of care. Dismantling these structures and policies will be very difficult once they are put in place. States must not invest in another form of detention. And then this goes on to say, all three authors work at the Center for Law and Social Policy in Washington, D.C. Jesse Fairbanks is a policy analyst at the Public Benefits Justice Team. Kaylin Rappaport is a policy analyst with the Racial Equity Team. And Isha Wersingi is Director of Public Benefits Justice Team. Over to you, Susan.
Thank you, Diane. Back to the Eagle Tribune, Merrimack Valley in a minute. In Lawrence, Irish Christmas Festival on Sunday. Stop by the 5th Annual Irish Christmas Festival and Sealy from 1 to 4 p.m. on Sunday at the Lawrence Elks Lodge, 65652 Andover Street. Enjoy an afternoon of Irish jig, local vendors, folk music by the Boston DJ, and more festivities. Admission is $15 for adults, $10 for children ages 6 to 18, and kids under can come in for free. The holiday event is sponsored by the Ladies Ancient Order of Hibernians and O'Shea Chaplin Academy of Irish Dance. The festival is also supported in part by a grant from the Lawrence Cultural Council and Mass Cultural Council. Embrace Irish culture, the Lawrence community, and Christmas cheer at the festival on Sunday. Contact Lawrence Elks Lodge 65 for more information at 978-687-7274. In North Andover, Rolling Ridge plans decorative showcase. Rolling Ridge Retreat and Conference Center is planning Christmas at Rolling Ridge from 2 to 7 p.m. Sunday, December 14th at 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, December 17th. Guests will be invited to stroll through decorated rooms at their own pace, then cast votes for their favorites. This is the first ever holiday decorating showcase at the 660 Great Pond Road North Andover Center and will involve staff and their family and friends adopting rooms in the Georgian manner with the intention of transforming the spaces into a festive wonderland. Bedrooms, meeting spaces, and the grounds will be adorned in holiday splendor, and you will have the opportunity to select the winners through your votes. This is a family-friendly event. Adults are $15 per person. Children ages 5 to 12 are $5. Children under 4 are free. Hot cider, hot chocolate, and other beverages and freshly baked Christmas treats are available as part of admission. For more information, email Marin, M-A-R-I-N, .Clark, C-L-A-R-K-E, at rollingridge.org or call 978-682-8815, extension 009. Lastly, in Haverhill, Best of the Bartenders. Any bartenders who think they can shake, stir, and serve smoother than the rest should sign up for next week's bartender competition, taking place at 6:30 p.m. on Monday at Bosa Coastal Italian, 160 Merrimack Street. Participants will step behind the bar to show off some of their best cocktails and concoctions for a chance to take home the $250 grand prize. The bartenders will also compete for the $100 People's Choice Award, voted on by event attendees. Prizes are awarded in the form of a BOSA gift card. This event is in support of the Somebody Cares Food Pantry, and all participants and guests are encouraged to bring donations to help local families this season. Suggested donations include shelf-stable canned goods, market basket gift cards, Christmas gifts for boys and girls, and gift cards for Walmart, GameStop, Amazon, and other retailers. For more information, call BOSA at 978-641-3149. Back to you, Diane.
Okay, I'm going to wrap up with X etiquette, if I could speak. Honoring both relationships during the holidays. Question. My husband of 9 years died in a car crash 3 years ago. I continued to spend the holidays with his parents each year. Last year, his mother passed away, so his father is all alone. My new fiance doesn't think we should spend the holidays with my former father-in-law. I understand his point of view, but this man has been family for years. He's 80 years old and all alone. What's good ex etiquette? And the answer is, first of all, I want to acknowledge the depth of your compassion and the complexities of your situation. Your loyalty to your former father-in-law is commendable and is understandable that you want to continue providing support to someone who's been a part of your life for so long. As for your fiancé's point of view, that's understandable as well. Blending families, especially after the death of a spouse, can be tricky. Your fiancé may feel that continuing to spend holidays with your former father-in-law is a reminder of your past, and that may bring up uncomfortable feelings for him. So, what's good ex-etiquette? It's perfectly acceptable to still care for and nurture relationships with people from your past, but the foundation of your relationship with your fiancé must also be nurtured. Start by having an honest conversation with your fiancé about your reasons for wanting to continue spending time with your former father-in-law. Let him know that you are not choosing your past over your present. It's not about one relationship winning over the other. It's about blending compassion, sensitivity, and mutual respect. All right, on that note, we are going to wrap up, and we thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading services, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune into LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Diane and Susan. We thank you for listening. Have a pleasant evening. It's going to be rainy, but rain is way better than snow. Whatever you do, stay safe and be kind to one another. Thank you.